Happy New Year. Are you looking forward to getting back to work today or Monday if you're taking the rest of the week off? Can you say you are truly happy at work? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to talk about happiness at work this hour with a leading meditation teacher. We will explore being committed without being consumed, being competitive without being cruel, and how to manage our time and emotions to counterbalance all the stress and frustration that we can find at work. And we will welcome your questions. How do you deal with job stress, competition, deadlines? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Is it possible to be successful and happy at work at the same time? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are very happy to have with us Sharon Salzberg, New York Times bestselling author, teacher of Buddhist meditation practices. She co-founded the Insight Meditation Society, and she is the author, most recently, of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why did you decide to concentrate on our work happiness?
Well, I had had a prior book come out, Real Happiness, and people often wrote into my blog on my website about their meditation practice and the progress or lack of progress they felt they were making. And we would discuss how it was really all progress. But one of the areas that people spoke about as feeling most troublesome for them, most stressful, was work. And so it really became an area of personal interest.
Mm-hmm. And do you need to meditate in order to be happy at work?
No, of course not. But I think that there are many qualities that make even a less than fulfilling work life or a difficult relationship with colleagues easier, and not only easier, but more fulfilling. And the more sense of inner happiness we have, the more we can give to others or to a mission or find a sense of meaning in what we're doing. And so for me, of course, meditation has been a tremendous tool, and I really see it as a set of skills training. It's almost like physical training, but mental training. Meditation has played that role in my own life so that I have an ability, for example, to begin again more gracefully when I've made a mistake or come back into the moment and actually focus.
So why is happiness so important at work?
Well, I think that if we actually redefine happiness, that also would be a useful thing instead of just seeing it as the experience of pleasure or minor satisfaction, getting what we want. If we redefine happiness as a sense of inner resourcefulness, a way of connecting very powerfully. So maybe, for example, you have a job that, you know, is not your dream job, and you have to do it, of course, in economic times, especially where there may not be that much flexibility. But you can find a level of meaning just in connecting to someone beautifully in some encounter, some stranger. And that makes a difference because then we have energy. We have the ability to go on. We don't feel so torn apart, you know, like I wish I was anywhere but here. And the more energy of that kind we have, that sense of inner sufficiency, the more we have to contribute to others.
You say that everyone who can breathe can find happiness even at work. What do you mean by that?
Well, this comes back somewhat to the meditation training, or it doesn't have to be formal meditation perhaps, but it's an ability, for example, when the momentum is getting crazy and we're getting really restless and we're caught up in others' reactions and we forget what we really care about, we have a tool for coming back into the moment, like, okay, let's just take a breath. Or one of my favorite examples, of course, is when we're starting to feel irate and irritated and we don't even quite know it, and we go off to the computer and we type out that email and we press send. Mm. And then maybe 2 hours later we go, whoops. That was said with some hostility, wasn't it? Maybe I'm not actually going to get what I want. And you know, in the old days, as one says, of email, there was an unsend button often on your server so that if a person receiving your angry, hostile email was using the same platform, you could press unsend, and something in your computer would somehow reach out to theirs and make it disappear. But life doesn't give us that many unsend buttons.
Right.
And so being aware of what we're feeling, being able to come back to remember what we actually want is a great, great thing. And we can use something as simple and universal as the breath as a means to actually do that.
You say, don't pick up the phone on the first ring. Let it ring three times, breathe, then pick it up.
Uh-huh.
Why?
Well, we get a sense of, first of all, it's kind of relaxing in the middle of a lot of stress, where the stress tends to propel us to go faster and faster and faster. And if we can just stop and pause a moment, then we have that sense of regrouping and not being so adrenalized. And from that place of some greater repose, we actually can make better decisions and make better choices. And so the phone ringing is actually like a great signal. It's like a mindfulness bell. It's like, oh, right, here's a moment when I can just stop.
And you say we should actually put on our calendar a breathing break.
Uh-huh. And why not? I have a friend who is a personal assistant to a very high-powered executive, and she put, for her boss, a one-minute breathing break on the calendar before significant meetings, before significant phone calls, so that there's just that chance to kind of remember, to come back to an awareness of your body, what you're feeling. And one of the great things, I think, is that does lead us to a much greater sense of what we care about, so that we can remember, oh, well, you know what? This is something I can compromise on comfortably, and this is what I have to really hold to, and you know, rather than just getting lost.
Yeah. Well, I have an office with a computer, but my workplace is also this radio studio, mm-hmm. And I'll have to. It was only a momentary panic that happened just before we went on the air. Normally, I see the guest name up on the computer, and I didn't see it right away. And I thought, I wonder if we're going to have a guest. And I had a momentary panic there.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that we should? This technique could help me just sit down, do it, take a deep breath. You think we should do a body scan every morning when we sit down at our workplace?
Mm-hmm. I think that would be very useful. I mean, I think the panic is natural, of course, you know. But what if I were not here somehow, or you didn't have a guest one morning? Then the range of options available to you would be broader, I think, coming from a place of calm, because something like panic really narrows our sense of possibility. We get lost, you know, like the positive part of some option rarely appears when we're panicked. It's like all bad all the time, or maybe even worse. And so being able to step back actually gives us a broader perspective.
Yeah, and I'm not going to fire off an angry email to Bill Martins, my on-air producer.
That's good, too.
But in any case, we have had that happen before, and yeah, you have to keep your wits about you because you have to come up with a different plan. But I am glad that you were there on the line and that we are talking about real happiness at work with Sharon Salzberg. She is a New York Times bestselling author, and she is the author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. And we'll wonder if you have found real happiness at work. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, I wanted to explore with you, Sharon, how to be committed at work and do a really good job, do the best job possible without being consumed by my job.
I think, of course, it's hard to remember in the pressures of an ordinary workday that we aren't bigger than our jobs, that our lives include values and other roles and responsibilities and joys. And this has something to do with resiliency, not being just consumed by that narrow definition of what's important. And one of the things I like people to do is to make a list, to write, first of all, in one column, what's the biggest source of stress at work for you? And then another column, write down what you do about it. What are the things you reach for? What are the things you enjoy? What lifts your spirit? What reminds you of a bigger perspective, of a bigger world? And then look at that first list and see, okay, is there anything I can do about some of this? Maybe if I commute differently, if I work out that really nasty relationship with a coworker, or whatever it is, that those sources of stress will be less. And then look at that second column very carefully. What do you do in order to find resiliency or repose? And really look at it carefully, because some of the things we do maybe are habitual and convenient, but they're not that helpful. You know, maybe we go out after work every day, or we bury ourselves in some distraction so that we are not really paying attention to our family, something like that. Maybe some of the things we do we want to enhance, and maybe we want to pick up some new tools, perhaps meditation, as a way of giving us a greater sense of resiliency.
Yeah. I'm thinking that my biggest joy at work is being able to talk to wonderful, knowledgeable guests like you and to convey this information to the many thousands of people who are listening right now. And I feel as though what I do can really make a difference in someone's life, and I get to learn something new every day, and that is a joy. But I also sometimes feel as though I am always reading books for work, and I'm on the computer at home putting things on Facebook for work. I go to bed very early because I have to get up very early for work. And so sometimes I feel as though I don't quite have that balance. I'm trying to figure out how I love what I do, but maybe I do it 24/7.
Well, there's that, too, and especially these days, of course, as everyone says, with all of our devices, that we may never actually get a break. And first of all, being conscious of that is the best thing, because then we're not just acting out of habit, and then we have the chance, if we wish, to make some shifts. So I know a group in New York City which is declaring January, which we're already in, a month of taking a one-hour fast each day from one's devices, and they asked me to join, and I wrote back with a story from Gandhi, where a mother brought a young boy to Gandhi and asked Gandhi to tell her son to stop eating sweets, and Gandhi said, come back in 2 weeks, and so she did, and then he forcefully told the boy, stop eating sweets. And then she said, why did you want the two-week gap? And Gandhi said, so I could stop that myself. You know, and so I felt like that. I thought, okay, I can sign your petition, but maybe give me 2 weeks when I can actually give up my device for an hour a day. And it was a good reminder, like, oh, yes, you know, it's the continuity of being engaged, involved, that we do need a break. We need a mental break, a physical break. And then things will open up for us.
We are talking about working happy, finding happiness at work. Have you found happiness at work? What is interfering with your happiness at work? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, The Joy Cardine Show, or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with a leading meditation teacher about finding real happiness at work. Sharon Salzberg is a New York Times bestselling author and the author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. And we're welcoming your questions on job stress, competition, deadlines, and how you can keep your balance and find some peace and happiness at work. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our first caller is Bill in Wakefield. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
Hi. Have you found happiness at work?
Yes, and I was very fortunate to hear the Dalai Lama speak in Chicago, and the topic was inner peace in a world of trauma. And it's one thing, I guess, to find the sense of balance, to kind of recalibrate yourself, that when you fall out of balance, you usually get really stressed out, and create your own sanctuary. If it's a room, property, a place where you can go and just kind of not think about anything.
Is that a refuge that you have at home or at work, Bill, or where?
No, I have some land that I created, that I purchased, that I use for a place of relaxation, where you could kind of eliminate all of your kind of problems and feel at peace.
Yeah, there we go. Get away from it all in some personal sanctuary, Sharon?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, the first part, I think, of the comment was also a very important point, that we have to have the ability to begin again, to regroup. And here's a perfect time. It's a new year. And because we will fall out of balance. We will get confused. We'll get overcome. We'll get exhausted. All kinds of things will happen. And one of the great, great things I learned in meditation practice, which I think is really at the core of meditation, is being able to begin again. You know, so I first went to India to learn how to meditate in the early 70s, and I had some fond notion that, okay, this may be a struggle for like a day, you know, but it'll really come easily, and it actually took longer than a day. And even in the midst of it, you know, the first instruction I had in meditation was sit down and feel your breath. And I thought, okay, what's it going to be, like 800 breaths before my mind wanders? And to my absolute astonishment, it was like one breath or two breaths, and I would just be completely lost. And what I began to understand after some time is that the key moment is after you've already been lost, and that is the ability to let go of whatever's distracted you, overcome you, tired you out. Just let go and start over. Have a sense of renewal and complete presence as you start over. And that's actually the hidden skill of meditation practice, and that's what we need, whether we meditate or not, to find a kind of resiliency at work.
Brad on Facebook says, trying to find happiness at work or in a job is usually a fool's errand.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to that?
I understand the point of view. I think that's why it's compelling to redefine happiness. We may not have the perfect job. We may not have the perfect colleagues. We may not have the perfect boss. That is absolutely true. And we may not feel, okay, I'll just find the perfect situation, because either that may not exist or we may not be in a position where we can even begin to look. And all of that is true about the conditions for many people. But there is a different kind of happiness than we might ordinarily be looking for. And that has to do, mostly I think it has to do with a sense of meaning. To understand that I may not be doing maybe the greatest task in the world, but I can find meaning in connecting to one person, in making someone's life a little better, in connecting to the land, and connecting to a bigger picture, that I did my craft as well as I possibly could today, that I was really present, that I wasn't disregarding someone else's needs or questions, that I really showed up in some way. That's a whole other kind of happiness, and that we can find, and I think it's essential that we find, because that's how we actually can contribute to others, to the well-being of others. If we're completely task-oriented and we're overcome and we're exhausted and we feel depleted and we feel miserable, we're not going to have an awful lot to give to anybody else.
Oh, boy, what if you feel as though the craft you are doing doesn't really have a, you know, a worthwhile purpose, that you think it really isn't contributing to the well-being of anything?
Well, I think every encounter has the potential of contributing to the well-being of others. One of my favorite stories from the book is about when I got into a taxi in New York City right at the time when, as the taxis cruise the street, they turn off their light if the shift change is happening and they have to turn in their cab. And yet they sometimes will stop and ask what your destination is, because they'll take one more passenger if where you're going is very close to where they need to drop off the cab. So I was on my way to hear a lecture by a Vietnamese teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, and it was just at shift change, and that's just what happened to me. So I got into this cab, and we started out to where we were going, and the traffic was hideous. It was unbelievable. I'd never seen anything like that. And we were just not getting anywhere and crawling and crawling. And I thought, okay, give up the idea of the lecture. You're never going to make it. But I really felt bad for the cab driver. I thought, wow, he was nice enough to pick me up, even though his shift was basically over. He's going to be quite late turning in the cab. I wonder if he gets penalized. Maybe he has to pay a fine. So I said to him, I'm so sorry that we're stuck in this traffic. I've never seen traffic anything like this. This is so terrible. I'm so sorry. And he said to me, Madam, traffic is not your fault, nor is it mine. And I thought, wow. First I thought, I don't even have to make it to the lecture, because I just got my nugget of wisdom. And I was especially happy about the nor is it mine, because I thought, how many times a day is he blamed for something that's not his fault, that he could never have controlled? And I thought, he actually gave me something very valuable in that, and I did make it to the lecture by like 1 second.
You know, it seems that a lot of us equate happiness at work, though, with things like getting that promotion or or praise or even experiencing the satisfaction of a job well done. Those things are important too, though, yes?
Oh, they are important, and I think we can put a lot of even ardent effort into achieving that, but we also need to realize that they're outside of our control often, that if you take something like praise, there's a kind of continuum of praise and blame. Sometimes we do something very well, and the person receiving that report's in a hideous mood for a whole other reason. And we can't, it doesn't mean, you know, we don't feel the impact that we're hurt. Of course we're hurt or we're displeased, but do we feel completely undone by the view of somebody else when we could never have absolutely controlled it to begin with? Or do we have a bigger sense of who we are?
Ian in Wapaka is with us now. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, it took me a long time to figure out that it wasn't what I was doing that was I thought would make me happy. It was who I was being at the time, whatever I was doing, what I was doing, trying to chase whatever job I thought would make me happy, and realizing that it was more about who I was being in that given moment, regardless of what I was doing, because we're called human beings, not human doings, if that makes sense.
Human beings, not human doings? Is that what you said, Ian?
Yes.
Yeah. So he was able to differentiate between who the person he was and the job he was doing, Sharon?
Yes, and that was beautifully put. And I think exactly right, that we can get that sense of fulfillment of being in harmony with what we really care about from how we're doing something as much or usually quite a bit more than what we are doing.
Yeah, it's so often people will ask, the first question when you meet them is, what do you do? And you do so often, that's the first thing out of your mouth, and you equate it with that, I am a talk show host.
Right, that's right.
And I'm a whole lot more than that. Fred in Palmyra is with us. Hello, Fred.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
My story is kind of strange. After a lot of years in the workaday world where I had to put up with a lot of immature behavior from my fellow workers, I decided, well, I'm going to go on my own and I will become an artist. And it provided a certain amount of autonomy, but no money. And the 80s were real rough. The economy dried up, and I couldn't find a job. And I finally ended up getting a part-time job driving a school bus. And I went like, oh, my God, really? You know, not me. I can't do this. But I had no choice. And so I started driving the school bus, and I tried for a number of years to get a real job with benefits, but I just couldn't seem to tell those human resource people what they wanted to hear. And after about 6 years of doing this, I woke up one morning and I said, you know, never really had to drag myself out of bed to go get my kids. So if I have to put up with, you know, childish and immature behavior from adults in my workaday world, you know, it always drove me crazy, and I speak my mind, and it would get me into trouble. But, if I have to put up with childish behavior, I can take it from kids. And, well, I mean, you know, over the years, we're gradually, you know, working our way out of the fix we were in back in the 80s, and the bills are paid, and, you know, I mean, we're surviving. My wife works, too.
Well, let me get it straight, though, Fritz. Are you saying that being a school bus driver part-time and an artist part-time is... you're happy doing that, and you're, is that what you're saying?
Well, the artist part is the itch I have to scratch. You know, it's a lot of work, and there's very little reward unless you can get into a gallery somewhere, but that's a whole other issue. But the thing is that driving the school bus is what keeps us alive, and as long as my boss's phone isn't ringing off the desk with people complaining, because if there's chaos on the school bus, the parents, find, you know, they bother the company, yeah. And as long as his phone is quiet on my route, he leaves me alone, and it gives me a certain amount of autonomy, and I like that.
I'm trying to get at with our guest is telling us how we can find some real happiness at work. Are you saying it doesn't really matter? It's just there to pay the bills, Fred?
Well, I guess I like this. I don't really mind it all that much. It's okay. And, you know, a lot of kids like me. And, you know, I guess fringe benefits like, you know, hugs and Christmas presents, you know, and stuff like that. But the thing is that, it's my idea of being a school bus driver is like less than it. The bar is a little low for what I figured I was worth.
Yeah.
But as time goes by, I realize that this isn't that bad, and if I have to meet up with people who look down their long nose at me because I only have a part-time job, and they ask me what I'm doing, I tell them I'm a manager and I have an office with a view. So,
I love it, Fred. Well, what about that if you feel you're doing work that's beneath you or that you don't think people respect, Sharon?
Well, I think that was a beautiful kind of resolution, and I love the way you said it, that if you have to put up with childish behavior, it might as well be from children. And that makes all the difference. I think that was really very skillful. It was well said. I think that, you know, it's true, of course, society in general may not honor or respect jobs. When you actually think about it, that is a tremendously important job, the care and safety of our children in any dimension, whatever the role is. And I would bet, I mean, that kids notice the difference, and that even years later, they may have some fond memory of, you know, there was that time that I was crying or I was freaked out or no one would talk to me or something happened on the school bus. And it all worked out. There was this guy who kind of helped me out. But because society doesn't applaud that in the way that we're taught we need in order to feel like a worthy human being, it's hard to remember that, yeah, you know, I can make a difference in a kid's life, and I need to do my job well, and I can enjoy that's really worth something, and I'm worth something. And that's why some of what I talk about and teach is really having those tools to remember that from the inside. And, you know, some of that might come from our family, it might come from people who love us and support us, and some of it can come from just our being reminded as we look within of our own value.
Gary on Facebook says, it seems to me that the main thing necessary to be happy at work and in life is deciding that you will be happy. Compare your situation to those less well off than those in a better situation. We all know some people who can always find a reason to complain about something, and we all know people who can almost always find something good to say about a situation. So he says, decide that you will be happy.
Well, that can be very useful, actually, in many ways. And there are a whole range of reflections and contemplations that, for many people, are a kind of stretch, but are really fascinating and important to do. So, for example, psychologists tell us that one of the most powerful things any of us can do is keep a gratitude journal, so that at the end of the day, we write down three things we're grateful for from that day. And I always say one of them can be that you're breathing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and especially if you orient that toward work, it would be very interesting. Like, what are three things that happened today? It could be an encounter. It could be that you're breathing. It could be you got something done. What are you grateful for from the day? Because many of us are conditioned, both personally or maybe culturally, to come to the end of the day and find the three things we can complain about the most. And we just go over and over and over that list of, you know, so-and-so was late, and that person disappointed me, and, you know, that didn't work out that well, and I didn't get the Nobel Prize today, and whatever it is. And so for many of us, it's a stepping out, stepping away from what is most obvious to us, most ready, most at hand in the story we're going to tell about the day, and stretch to include that which was good, that which was positive. And that exercise is a very, very good thing. It takes us out of that rut of habit, and it's not moving from something that's true to something that's untrue. It's being more inclusive. It's being broader. It's being fuller in our understanding of our day. And so that kind of thing is very good. I also really like meditation in this regard, in just that practice of, say, coming back to the breath, coming back to the moment, because for many of us, it's powerful and important to have a resolution, to have a new direction, to decide, okay, I'm going to be happy. But how do we remember when there are three phones ringing, when we're being blamed for something we feel unfairly, when, you know, the tasks are piling up, when someone is not doing their job as fully as we need? You know, how do we remember that we want to relate differently, we want to have better communication, that we want to carry out that sense of happiness? We need some tools for being able to make it real.
And I love the idea of the gratitude journal. I did a 30 days of gratitude in November, and I do see how it can help in many ways. But how does it help with that employee who's late, or your coworker who doesn't do his or her share of the project, and it's causing you a lot of grief?
Well, that can remain true. I mean, that's you know, the gratitude is not obliterating that by any mm-hmm. means, but it's giving us a different kind of energy with which we can then deal with the problems. If we feel they're only problems and this is fruitless and nothing good is happening at all, then we just get more and more and more exhausted. And we're not going to have the kind of energy or sense of creativity or possibility that we need in order to try to make a difference in those other very troublesome and genuinely so areas. And so it's for the sake of our own well-being. And this comes back to that question of happiness or well-being. It's not selfish, and it's not a waste of time, and it's not just being self-preoccupied or kind of superficial. It's a very deep need to have some wherewithal, some sense of inner resourcefulness in order to deal effectively with problems. We can't have nothing inside.
We are talking with Sharon Salzberg, New York Times bestselling author. She is a teacher of Buddhist meditation practices, and she co-founded the Insight Meditation Society. She is the author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. And we're welcoming your questions for her. Have you found happiness at work? What's interfering with your happiness at work? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We We are talking with Sharon Salzberg, author of Real Happiness at Work, and we're welcoming your questions about how to achieve a real happiness at work. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You have in the book, Sharon, 8 pillars in finding real happiness at work. We talked a little bit about balance, the ability to differentiate who you are and what your job is. Talk a little bit about the other pillars. How about concentration?
Concentration is really a fantastic tool to be able to focus. I think the great myth of our time is that multitasking will get the job done, but really we tend to be scattered, and the outer manifestation of that kind of scatteredness or distractedness is a sense of fragmentation. We just feel pulled apart all over the place. And the simple act of gathering all our scattered attention and energy will give us a much greater sense of power, for one thing, because that's an awful lot of energy that could be available to us, but it's not, because it's just flying all over the place into kind of useless rumination about the past or anxious rumination about the future. And this is different than a useful or skillful way of recollecting the past or planning for the future. This is just really frittering our energy away. And especially with anxiety, as we begin to create these scenarios, like say you, in fact, had no guest today, and there was that moment when you thought, oh, what if? And then what if? And what if? But then what if? You know, and so none of that really is that useful for us, and we lose a tremendous amount of our life's energy that way. So concentration is like a gathering. It's bringing it back. It's bringing it home so that all that energy does become available to us, and we feel much stronger for it.
Another of the 8 pillars is compassion. Why is compassion a key ingredient in creating happiness at work?
Well, the intricacies of relationships are very real, and I had someone come to me when I was teaching a meditation class, and she said, oh, you know, my boss has just been a tyrant this past week, and she's just not liked anything, and she's been nagging us, and she's been so difficult. And she said, it was only now, a week later, after this meditation, that it occurred to me to think, I wonder if she has something going on in her life that's difficult. She's not usually like this. And I said to her, well, do you have the kind of relationship where you can ask? And she said, yes, I do. And she said, I think I will. You know, that we forget people are human, and that we get caught, all of us get caught in all kinds of turmoil and troubles. And we can have a basic sense of caring about others. It doesn't mean we lose a sense of principle or defending ourselves or any of the things we might be nervous about, like, oh, no, if I'm kinder, then I'm going to be a doormat, is a common thought. But it's really not like that. And to have that sense of kindness and care makes a very big difference. I mean, I've had tremendous experiences, for example, wonderful experiences in Wisconsin, in Madison, like flying in on a flight that was extremely late and finding that the rental car company had stayed open because they knew they had customers coming in on a plane that was going to be late. And I thought, look at that, you know?
Yeah.
What a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Resilience, the ability to recover from defeat, frustration, or failure. I can see how that would be important to your happiness. Can you help us build some of that resilience?
Some of that, some people at work face, you know, what seem like insurmountable tasks. They face a lot of suffering on the part of others. They're trying to make a difference through their work. And whether it's through the sheer volume of the work we need to do or the things that we face when we're working, we can burn out. People really do burn out. It's like your whole nervous system just goes on overload. And one of the things that is very, very hard to remember is that we need to take care of ourselves. It really matters that we take some breaks, that we get some relief, that is an indulgence and it's not, you know, some terrible thing to do. This is very, very important. The example people use so commonly these days is, you know, what if you're on the airplane and the flight attendant is making the safety announcements and they say, in the event of a change in pressure and the oxygen mask coming down, put your own on first before you try to take care of anybody else. And isn't selfish, and it isn't just weird. It's like we have to do that. One of the women I was working with in teaching meditation was directing a domestic violence shelter center, and she said that her resolve for taking care of herself was to take a lunch break. And everyone else in the room was like, you don't take a lunch break? And she said, no, I can't. The demands are too many. And so she would report in as we would meet. And one week she came in and she said, well, I tried and I locked the door to my office, but somebody bent down and looked through the keyhole to see if I was inside, and it didn't work. And then she came in a few weeks later and she said, it worked. She said, I locked the door and I turned out the light.
Uh-huh.
And I got a lunch break. And
yeah, well, I'm going to resolve to take a lunch break, too.
All right.
Lori in Hills Corners is with us. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I imagine that I've been told that I am a person that doesn't have an off button. I get involved in way too many things, and I distract myself from my distraction, that kind of thing. And I have a feeling I'm not the only person that has that problem. So, and I've never thought that, well, for instance, I'm with a group that likes to do a 20-minute meditation, and I don't like that.
Oh, she can't slow down enough to meditate. But Sharon, what advice might you have for someone without an off switch?
Well, there are lots of options for meditation. You could do walking meditation, for example. You could do yoga. You could do martial art, you know, if you wanted to get into it. Just to have that sense of mindfulness and balance and concentration, but in movement, which might feel better. Also, there are lots of styles of meditation, like loving-kindness meditation, which I teach quite a lot, which are a little more active. You're not working, say, with the feeling of the breath. You're working with repeating phrases of well-wishing for yourself and for others, and so that can be more engaging. It can be more active. And I think it's also powerful just to look at your motivation, what's happening in your body, the kinds of things that are cooking when you're about to say yes to something. Sometimes it's wonderful, and of course the things we do and get involved in enrich our lives and make our lives really bigger. Sometimes people say yes because there's a kind of panic about saying no. And, oh no, I'll miss out, or oh no, I'll disappoint people. I can't say no. I have to do everything. I have to be everything for everybody. And that's a very interesting thing to get familiar with. What does that feel like in your body? What's the wave coming of panic that's starting to come over you as you're being asked something or to be involved in something? Because sometimes when it's just that, when it's mostly that kind of panic and, you know, I can't disappoint anybody, I have to be all things for all people, that's worth noticing, because the next time it happens, that's the signal. Like, okay, maybe this one time, to begin with, I'm going to try to say no, just for this one thing. It's like baby steps. I don't have to completely reform my life, but maybe this is the moment where I don't add yet another thing. And so it's like a self-knowledge that's really useful for us.
Lori, thanks for the call. Lynn in Eau Claire is with us now. Hello, Lynn.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to your guests. I'm just a housewife. And boy, have I heard that way too many times. I've had a paying job. I'm not college educated, but that doesn't mean I'm not intelligent. And I'm doing what I want to do. I do have value. In our society, if you're not making a paycheck, if you're not bringing, if there's not dollars associated with what you do, then you are marginalized. And I used to feel that, and now I don't. Now, my reason for being, for getting up, for producing, is just to do it. I now have grandchildren, and I'm teaching them the art and craft of the domestic arts and it's domestic arts and sciences, and it's life skills, and I'm happy because it's the joy is in the doing.
Yeah, she's found some meaning there, right, Sharon?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I once helped a friend who was also just a housewife do her resume as she was going back to seek work outside the home, and it was a little bit like the bus driver who's the manager with a room with a view. You know, it was like a fantastic exercise in really capturing some of what she did, which is enormously responsible. She was a manager. She was, she was an HR person, basically. She had tremendous skills and exercised them in the most loving way. And so I think here, too, it's like our sense of integrity is not best placed on society's view of our worth. And I try to be careful in the book to include people who work inside the home, people who worked outside the home, and to recognize that there's a tremendous level of responsibility that many people share. You know, their lives, their everyday lives are filled with that, and they may not be honored by society in the same way.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lynn, for the call. Yeah, the other of the eight pillars of happiness in the workplace, and we've talked about them, but maybe not step by step. Communication, integrity, meaning, and open awareness. In our final minutes, Sharon, I mean, what would you like to leave our listeners with when it comes to those who are trying to find real happiness at work now that we start a new year?
I think it's actually possible. I tweeted something out about real happiness at work, and somebody responded to me on Twitter by saying, "What makes me happy is thinking it's only 8 hours a day for the next 40 years." You know, and I thought, "Oh, that's a little dire." Mm-hmm. Like, we can be a whole lot happier than we think, and that it makes a difference for us and it makes a difference for others.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sharon Salzberg, New York Times bestselling author, teacher of Buddhist meditation practices in the West. She co-founded the Insight Meditation Society and is author of Real Happiness at Work, Meditations for Accomplishment, Achievement, and Peace. And we thank her very much for being with us. Thanks to Marika Suval. She produced this program. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Christy Taylor for on-air production and direction. And thank you for listening. Coming up tomorrow at this time, I'm trying to remember. I think we're going to have another, the Week in Review tomorrow, aren't we? Yeah, that's what we're going to have. It's Friday. So we will have two guests from different political viewpoints to talk with you about all the news stories of the week. My day's a little bit mixed up since because of the holidays. It doesn't seem like Thursday for some reason. But it is, and tomorrow is Friday, and we will have the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.